My guest at this time is former Ohio Congressman Bob Ney. He was elected as part of the Republican Revolution in 1994 and served nearly 12 years in Congress. He, however, resigned prior to completing his sixth term. He was eventually sentenced to 30 months in prison in connection with the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. He is now out, he is now sober, and he's now the author of the brand new book, Sideswiped, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen of Capitol Hill. And sir, thank you very much for your time tonight.
Well, thank you.
You point out in the book that you entered politics, served at the state level, eventually got elected to Congress in 1994 for the right reasons. Talk about being part of the Republican Revolution in 1994 and how your vision of what public service was met with reality when you got here to Washington.
Well, you know, as I chronicle in the book, Sideswiped, it's interesting because they said, they meaning five, six, seven members of Congress called me and said, you can win this district. We want you to run for Congress. There's going to be this revolution, this contract with America. And I just kept refusing because it wasn't the right reason. I didn't want to go to Congress. You know, anyone wanted me to be a congressman was my mom, you know, for the title. And then I met Newt Gingrich, and he gave me the right reasons. They were going to, you know, do all these wonderful things. And so that's how I ran. And I got a seat that was at that time about 13% Republican index. So it was a tough seat. But I felt I was running because I wanted to change America as we knew it, and we had a small window of opportunity to do it.
How much of the corruption process, not necessarily the criminal corruption process, but the part where political money, as you see it, and special interests were basically compromising members of Congress. How clearly did you see it when you weren't engaged in that, and how easily were you drawn to that side of it?
Well, in the beginning, it was there. I didn't know it in the sense that I looked at it, and that's the way the system works. I had been a state senator and a state rep, but of course in Washington it was on steroids compared to the state legislature. And it was very clear we had to, quote, keep this revolution going in 1996, this Republican Revolution. We needed money to do it. We had to raise money. You had to get on the telephones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, crossing the bright line didn't occur till later in my career, but doing what, quote, everybody did, you know, you leave, you take your staffer who's on federal time, you go to a call center, you dial for dollars, you raise money, you're doing all these things. People have receptions for you. They come to see you. The staff comes in and says, oh, by the way, so-and-so wants to see you, and, you know, they are contributors. You know, so that type of conversation was from day one. Now, we still, in a personal level, I mandated constituents would get to see me. But I've got to tell you, from day one, The way Washington works was the way it worked. Crossing the line, eventually, on my part, came a little bit later.
And when it did, and your involvement with the Abramoff fiasco, is it something where you knew in your gut that this was absolutely wrong, or had the slow compromise over those years gotten you to the point where other people are doing this, so it's not that big of a deal?
You ask a really good and telling question, because I don't sugarcoat this. I'm not St. Bob in this book. And very clearly, people were, not everything I did they were doing, but people were, you know, drinking and eating for free both sides of the aisle. There were times I would have to try to shove Bush White House staffers away from Jack Abramoff's bar to try to get a drink, to be frank with you, and that's a fact. And so that part of it was like, yeah, okay, everybody does it, so what? Free dinners. Then, of course, that morphed into a trip. That morphed into to Scotland. That morphed into, you know, doing things, signing things, Sun Cruise. I mean, a guy got shot in a phone booth down there during that Sun Cruise fiasco. Jack Abramoff lied on his forms. I was part of pressuring that man, Gus Bullis, that was eventually murdered by somebody down there. I was part of pressuring that guy to get out, you know, of the vote business, and that's what Jack Abramoff had wanted. I didn't realize the full repercussions, but I should have said, why am I writing this? No, I'm not going to write it. Why are we being offered all the free food we want? My staff's being offered. No, not going to do it. So I crossed that line, A, knowingly and stupidly, I may add as a B, and C, a lot of people get free things, a lot of people get free dinners, so what?
So
that attitude.
This was obviously building as the 2006 election season came, and there had been reports of your involvement with Abramoff and so forth, and you were planning to run for re-election that year and actually won the Republican primary, ultimately pulling out and resigning right around Election Day. But what was your thinking process at that point, that you could figure out a way to survive it? How are you approaching that politically?
In 2006, I had an electron microscope on me by the United States government. Alberto Gonzalez, of course, ran the Justice Department. And I was just being battered and beaten around. My consultant told me in December of 2005 that Mickey Mouse would beat me in a primary in 2006. Time to get out, time to retire. Maybe sometimes when you leave, this all goes away, you know. It's happened before. And I met with my main consultant, and who happened to be a neighbor of mine, and he said, what do you want to do? I said, I don't want to stop. You know, I've been in this career a long time, so we went ahead. And we didn't have money, and we were battered and bruised, and walked out of a primary with 69% of the vote. I think we were as shocked as everybody else that followed this in the country. Then it was full steam ahead. You couldn't stop me at that point in time. I was going on to November. 70 days before the election, I got a call from now Speaker John Boehner, then Majority Leader Boehner, and he wanted me to step out of the race, and I did.
Ultimately, you did plead guilty to corruption charges. You were sentenced in 2007 for 30 months. You point out in the book that prison, while very rough and not nearly the cakewalk that a lot of Americans may think it is at the federal level, really did change you for the better. Explain how.
It's a terrifying thing. I had a guy on the first day said, hey, you did the Sudafed law, you put me in here. So you sort of feel like a policeman, in a sense, going to prison. The experience helped me to look at a lot of changes I needed to make. Also, it gave me an insight into what we really are doing in the prison system and how we have failed so many people inside those walls. But that's how it changed me a lot, gave me a new perspective. You know, people don't tell the truth to avoid prison, but once you go through prison, it gives you a little bit more streak of being out front and blunt.
As we mentioned at the outset, but not in the narrative of what led to your downfall on Capitol Hill, alcohol had become a significant factor in perhaps some of your decisions and the erosion of your public service up there. How did that sobriety come about in prison?
I've been very careful with this because of the fact that people say, oh, you're blaming it all on alcohol. I'm not blaming it all on alcohol. I had bad behavior, criminal behavior, the wrong thought process, everything. But alcohol didn't help whatsoever. And I'm a recovering alcoholic as we speak. I went into prison 2 weeks short of 6 months sober. I went to an amazing, tough but amazing rehab program in prison. It's called RDAP, and it's not available, unfortunately, to as many people as it should be. That program helped me so much in prison to look at, you know, my willingness to stay sober, and to firsthand view how lack of sobriety affected so many people that I served with, and with drugs and alcohol, in such a horrific way to really hurt their lives and the collateral damage to families, my own and to their families, that people I served with.
You mentioned your new respect for bluntness. You also mentioned in passing now Speaker John Boehner, who ultimately asked you to step out of the race in 2006. Your characterization of his reputation in Congress and certainly of how he treated you is also pretty blunt in the book. Explain for our listeners what most folks thought of him back at that time and what your personal experience was him, particularly as you left Congress.
You know, I've known John Boehner for over 2.5 decades. I don't hate John Boehner. I don't hate John Boehner today. Was I angry at John Boehner in 2006? You better believe it. I make no bones about that. But John Boehner has always been, and this is my opinion, but I think the opinion of many, has been on the lazy side in the sense of he's a get-along guy. He doesn't like a lot of controversy. He's always enjoyed, the golfing. It's almost, I would have to term it an addiction for John Boehner, the golfing. And I'm not calling anyone an alcoholic, being a recovery alcoholic, but I've got to tell you, John Boehner is a constant, especially particularly drinker of wine. Again, he's been seen with lobbyists for decades on a nightly basis in drinking. And I'm not judging him, but it's part of the story. And I didn't just pick on John Boehner. In this book, he was part of the whole Abramoff scenario, and it's kind of a complicated puzzle within the book Sideswipe, but I must tell you that John Boehner today, I think part of this whole sequestration and the fiscal cliff is just John Boehner's general attitude, and he has been in the throes of lobbyists and money and giving checks out on the floor of the House over and over and over. As many people, both sides of the aisle have, but he has a chance as the Speaker of the House to clean this whole mess up because I had an addiction to a substance. They are still addicted today, both sides of the aisle, to campaign contributions. And the only intervention is going to be the public to stop it.
Talk about that a little bit more, because as you say, that's obviously a major position shift from where you were when you're in Congress, is that you believe the corruption and the special interests, cronyism will be out of politics if we go to publicly financed campaigns. The obvious counter to that argument, which we heard in the Supreme Court cases and everywhere else, is that limits the rights of individual people. If they really have a strong opinion, they can give money to different candidates or different parties through the Citizens United decision. You've got the corporations who can do that as well. So what do you say in response to the argument that public financing is a restriction on free speech?
You know, I was against public financing in Congress. I was also against John McCain's campaign finance bill. I mean, the maverick did nothing to clean the system up or stop money. In fact, he encouraged it through loopholes of 527s that ran around that bill. Now, I would again say that the perfect solution is campaign is public financing if they can find a way to do it and to fit through the Constitution. So I mentioned that. I have to. There are other ways. I even had it in writing. They charge you, both parties, you want to be chairman of a committee, you want to be chairman of appropriations, $500,000. You want to be chairman of House Administration, which I chaired, it was $150,000. The leaders can take endless amounts of money. That all needs to be taken away. It needs to be curtailed on especially the leaders, both parties, who can pressure people for votes when pharma or whatever group comes in to spend a fortune. The other thing that can be done is absolutely stop the complete revolving door. You want to be a member of Congress. You want to be a staffer. You're not going to be a lobbyist. I'm not against lobbyists and advocacy groups. They educate. But this whole access deal has got to be curtailed.
Sir, why did you ultimately write the book?
I finally decided to tell my end of the story as I see it, and also to expose the fact that prisons are not working functionally. Other people that can't speak out like I can are under the gun of people in unfair situations in probation that dooms them to go back into prison. And also I wanted to tell the part about the character of people involved, John Boehner, Barry Jackson, and my former chief of staff, to save Dave DeStefano, all these people involved with the White House, Alice Fisher, who was involved with the Attorney General Gonzalez, and their role in this, I felt, needed to be, you know, exposed to the public light so they know what's going on, and to know that corruption still continues within, you know, the beautiful house that I so love on the Hill. So it wasn't just a book that I did, you know, to get somebody. I chaired House Administration. I know the inside stories of a lot of things. If I wanted to write a salacious book, it would have been a lot better than the one I wrote, and I could have just, you know, attacked people all over the place. My goal was to shed light on this. I didn't do it lightly, and I took some time to do it. And I feel it's therapeutic, frankly, too, for me.
Well, there's certainly a lot of difficult topics discussed, and obviously that could not have been easy, but we appreciate you not only sharing the book with us, but sharing your time with us today. Thank you, sir, very much.
Thank you, sir.
Former Ohio Republican Congressman Bob Ney was elected to 6 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, served 30 months in prison in relation to the Jack Abramoff scandal, now is the author of the brand-new book Sideswiped, Lessons Learned Courtesy of the Hitmen on Capitol Hill. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WND.com.